Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today we are pleased to present the Walter Hoadley Annual Economic Forecast, named in honor of the club's late president and longtime board member, Dr. Walter Hoadley. Mr. Hoadley also served most notably as chief economist and vice president of the Bank of America. We wish to thank the Walter E. Hoadley Memorial Fund and Bank of America for the generous sponsorship of today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Tom Campbell, Bank of America Dean of the Haas School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley. In addition to being the Dean of the Haas School of Business, Tom Campbell was also a former congressman, former California State Senator, and most recently, California's Finance Director. He is the 13th Dean of the Haas School of Business, a position he has held since August of 2002. And at UC Berkeley, he focuses his efforts on improving the Haas School to be among the very top business schools in the world, by achieving financial self-sufficiency, and by building on its excellence in teaching, research, and public service. Under his leadership, the Haas School is dedicated to teaching young men and women about business and the creation of opportunity, and is equally committed to offering lessons in the importance of sharing the opportunities and wealth that come from successful pursuit of business. He is truly qualified to lead the youth of today as they define their future. He's a native of Chicago, earned his bachelor's and master's degree in economics at the University of Chicago and a law degree from Harvard in 79. He returned to the University of Chicago, earning his PhD in economics in 1980. His dissertation was the first quantitative measurement of discrimination against women in federal civil service employment. He's also written a book, Segregation of Powers and Practice, which examines the constitutionally defined roles and powers of the justice, legislative, and executive branches of government, and then suggests which branches might best address some of America's most contentious policy issues. His deep background in law and economics, his diverse leadership position as a congressman, a senator, and finance director, he is a man of action and a man of compassion, and it has allowed him to experience both the theory and practice of how the world works. He is going to be a fabulous speaker for us today. Tom.
Thanks, Evelyn. Thank you. Evelyn, what a lovely introduction. I'll just take a second to say I really mean it about the Haas School of Business. We think that our job is not done if we train our students in the skills to create opportunity. The equally important task is the virtues, the values of sharing the opportunity that that we create with others. That's why we are, I think, the best public business school in the world. Go Bears. I wanted to thank you for very much. It's a very thoughtful introduction. Can you give me a moment of pity? I had prepared all of my remarks last week. And what do you do when the newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle, in this case, I'm not making this up, in the just the front and the business section has articles on the FHA bailout, the growth of GDP, venture capital confidence dropping, housing prices dropping, Ken Rosen of the University of California, Berkeley Fisher Center predictions on housing, inflation, federal funds rate, and I was prepared to talk about the candidacy of Rudolph Giuliani. Flexibility in all things. keeps you ready to give a presentation such as this. Let me jump in to say that the fundamental situation right now is a slow growth period, 0.6% growth in GDP for fourth quarter 2007 was announced by the Commerce Department this morning. And the definition of recession is two quarters of negative GDP, so we are in slow growth, not in in recession. The origin of this problem is quite clearly the drop in housing values. And I want to distinguish that from the subprime crisis. They're both important, but the real focus should be on the fact that housing values ran up. We had a bubble. And that bubble affected consumption behavior, and now the bubble has popped. Here's some statistics on that. From first quarter of 96 to the last quarter of 06, the value of the housing stock in the United States rose from $6.5 trillion to $20.5 trillion, more than a threefold increase. If you simply kept pace with inflation, it would have gone up by 48%. Instead, it's going up by over 300%. Okay, that's the bubble. That's the growth. And in the last year, that number, that 300% number, finished off in December of 06. So from December 06 to December 07, nationally, we've had a drop of 7.7%. That is not much after a 300% run-up. In the state of California, the drop has been 16.5%. So the decline is upon us, but look at the growth that preceded it. It was long overdue for a correction. And the reason I emphasize that is you get a lot of attention on the fact that nobody may be too great a statement, but very few people are now withdrawing from their equity in their homes. You're not getting so many refinancing to withdraw equity and spend it. But that was a small, small part of economic consumption stimulus. The Federal Reserve Board study, actually authored by former Chairman Alan Greenspan, gave the following estimate that from 91 to 2005, the equity extraction, the so-called mortgage equity withdrawal effect, was an average of 1% of personal consumption, just 1%. So the fundamental is this, that people have what's called a wealth effect in deciding how much they spend. They take a self-analysis of how much wealth they have. And in America, we save by our houses. That's where we put most of our savings. And so with this 300% run-up, we had a concomitant increase in consumption. It's now flattening out, declining a little bit, nationally 7.7% in the last year. That is the effect that needs our attention. And it's essential in addressing this crisis that we target our relief to that phenomenon. Get people who might leave their homes to stay in their homes because that's how they save, that's how they build up wealth, and that wealth effect is the largest contributor of the housing sector to the GDP. I want to give you some statistics about how consumption has been going up. Today, I told you the rate of growth of GDP is slowed for the fourth quarter at 0.6, but in the third quarter, it was 4.9, second quarter, 3.8. We are slowing, but we are not tanking. And this was in the face of, over those same two quarters, 11.8% and 20.5% drop in residential investment. So, sector by sector, you don't particularly want to be in residential home construction right now. And for this, you paid how much to hear my advice? But let's not overstate the problem. It is relatively clear that sector is in trouble. It is not clear that we have had the devastating effect on the wealth effect yet with only that 7.7% result following a 300% increase. So the long-term increase of wealth is the issue, and that, at least at present, is not at crisis potentials. The other sources of growth in the economy are strong, and I want to take a second to give some of those so that we put this in proper perspective. Real wages, productivity, and international trade-related segments are still quite positive. First of all, real wages. The Federal Open Market Committee reported in December 11th, says it's part of the Federal Reserve, job growth rebounded in October and November. Fed officials expect continuing gains in employment and income to support consumer spending. Now, that, of course, has hit a slowing of the growth in jobs in December. Remember, we heard 19,000 new jobs were created, which contrasted poorly with 115,000 in November, 159,000 in October. But it's new jobs. It's not negative jobs. It's not drop in employment. I wish it was more than 18,000 in December, but it was positive, not negative. The unemployment rate, 5%. In the United States, that was up from 4.7% last quarter, due entirely to the construction sector, particularly the residential construction sector. 5%, sure, I wish it was 4.7, but compare that with a recent high of 6.3% in June of 2003. California, we've gone up now to 6%. That certainly is worse than the 4.7% we had in November of 06, but substantially less than the 6.9% we had in October of 03. Now, the real growth effect is largely due to the fact that we have had a substantial increase in productivity. And I think this is a time when we just have to make sure we don't lose sight of the fundamentals. Productivity, output per worker, largely related to American economy's ability to infuse technology into our productive sector. We are doing it, have done it, and will continue to do it, as well as any economy on earth. The new numbers for the fourth quarter were not out as of midnight last night when I was last on the internet, but I can give you third quarter growth in productivity, and that's 6.3%. How does that compare with previous years? Last year, 1.0, that's 2006 was 1.0, 2005, 1.9, 2.7, 3.7. So we have a substantial reason for optimism in the context of productivity, the output per worker. Now, the wages that are going up are hourly wages, and they continue to go up. What's interesting is weekly wages are beginning to turn down. So what's the difference between hourly wages going up and weekly wages going a little bit south? The answer is employers do not believe that the economy is headed for a long-term decline. So they're still willing to pay high wages, reflecting high productivity, but work fewer hours rather than lay off individual employees or cut wages, which would be effective, responsive to the same phenomenon. In other words, productivity stays high. Employers are seeing a value in workers. Wages, therefore, stay high. If there's a downturn, it's being responded to by shorter work week rather than by layoffs. Trade, the dollar has declined. I never thought I would see the Canadian dollar worth more than the U.S. dollar. So to our Canadian friends, félicitations, and please buy more of our hardwood. It's appropriate for us to sell hardwood to Canada. And I think we'll be exporting maple syrup in the near future. And would you ever have guessed it? So here's how the impact of trade in the last two quarters, for which data are available, the GDP growth, this is before the 0.6, was 3.8, 4.9, and in those same periods, 1.3 and 1.4 were due to trade. Figure, if the dollar goes down, we're selling more overseas, cheaper prices. Europe, Asia are buying our goods. This is something that we also need not to lose sight of. Federal Reserve Open Market Committee notes of December 11th, the available data shows strong growth abroad, solid gains in U.S. exports. Rising foreign demand was benefiting U.S. producers of manufactured goods and agricultural goods in particular. So we have a clear problem in the housing valuations not continuing to grow, and obviously a deep problem in subprime. We have that bleeding over into financial institutions. Again, everyone in the room knows this, with the write-downs in many, many investment banks' portfolios. But because of the mortgage-backed security phenomenon, The risk of these adjustable rate mortgages and subprime mortgages was very broadly spread. Yes, it hurts, and yes, we've had major write-downs in almost all of the investment banks, notably not Goldman Sachs, who apparently shorted the subprime market, showing remarkable wisdom. But it appears to be losses taken on the books, CEOs fired, and no single bank closed. No bank closures, despite what is obviously a very deep problem in one sector. The residential construction sector, obviously, also an area of specific concern, the construction there in particular. Okay, how do we prevent this wealth effect from spreading the depressing effect of the bubble bursting in real estate into the general economy? That's, I think, the task for our public policy focus today. First of all, Secretary Paulson, the voluntary workout that the Treasury has put forward, I'm going to say positive things about this. I think it's right on two accounts. For review, what he has done is to encourage the holders of these adjustable rate mortgages to sit down with the representatives of the homeowners and renegotiate, but it's voluntary. That's the right thing to do, in my view. You want to keep people in their homes if it's at all possible, because that builds up the wealth effect. When you become a renter and are no longer a homeowner, the wealth effect tanks. The second part about this that I like is it's voluntary. You do not want the federal government rewriting private contracts. You do not want the federal government undermining the reliability of financial markets. And you do not want the lawsuits that will follow as surely as the sun rises tomorrow if the federal government were to do so, just as they did after the home loan crisis of the middle to late 80s. You remember all of the lawsuits that followed where the federal government said, here's some goodwill, regulatory goodwill, and then took it away, and the beneficiaries brought lawsuits saying that constitutes taking without compensation, a violation of the Constitution. Well, believe me, that's the sort of lawsuit you're going to have. If the federal government comes in, and some of the candidates for president, I'm not going to be too specific today, because, as I said, my remarks on Rudy Giuliani and Dennis Kucinich are no longer as topical as I had hoped. But you can fill in whoever you think I might be talking about. The plan, why don't we have the federal government come in and do an absolute no more modifications of interest rates? You do that, and you have made many, many class action plaintiffs' lawyers very happy. I don't know if that was your goal, but that's what you will have done. And more importantly, you will have undermined the confidence in the market. So do it voluntarily, and I think you're already seeing it worked out. So why is there a need at all for the government? Why is Paulson's proposal needed at all? Because the danger is if one starts and the other financial institutions does not go along, conceivably Wall Street might take a hit against that one for writing down the value of its portfolio of loans. So action together makes some sense, facilitated by the feds. That, I think, is a good approach. This concern about keeping people in their houses was most clearly expressed in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal December 10th. It's a numerical example to keep in mind. Quote, if you owe more money on a house than the house is worth, right, which is distinctly possible, particularly if you put zero money down, foreclosure can be a perfectly rational choice. Suppose Mr. Smith bought a house for $300,000 with no money down, but the value of that house has now fallen to $270,000. If he refinances or sells the house, he would still owe the mortgage servicer an additional $30,000, right? Falling home prices in many areas provide a powerful incentive to default on the loan, live rent-free for many months, and then hand the keys to the bank. Those who bought homes with no money down have nothing to lose by walking away if they can't resell their homes at a profit. That's Alan Reynolds, Senior Fellow, Cato Institute, Wall Street Journal, December 10th, page A19. So that, I think, is the reason for the Treasury's action, and I think it's right. Second, it's a very good development that the House bill that's currently pending, the economic stimulus bill, would increase the ability of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to purchase mortgages above the present level at $417,000 and up into the $700,000. That step, long overdue for people in California, will do an awful lot to start up the process again of people buying homes. And then, of course, we begin to get the turnover effect, which is valuable in state revenues. I'll pause just for a moment to explain what I meant by that. I'll come back to it at the end. State revenues are down, right? $14.5 billion deficit this year and next in the state budget. Why? Because homes are not turning over. Because of Prop 13, you get that kick up in the value of the house only when it's sold. It's a trivial increase otherwise. You're a county with an obligation to pay for the schools. The state then, under Prop 98, has the obligation to pay for the schools if the counties can't, because the county's real estate revenue has dropped. Why is the real estate revenue dropped? Because the homes are not turning over. And there's also in this the inkling of positive, because you don't have to wait for a reestablishment of the high house values. You just have to get turnover. You buy a house 20 years ago for $200,000. You sell it now for $700,000. Had you sold it last year, it would have been $800,000. Okay, but the jump from $200,000 to $700,000 is something that the county is waiting to capture in the real estate taxes the new owner pays. The present problem of the state of California financially is related to the slow turnover, not the low value, because that pent-up value is so high. So I really see a turnaround coming pretty quickly once we get stimulus in the market to purchase, and that's where the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac increased eligibility will be very helpful. So that's in the House bill currently pending in the Senate. The Senate is proposing adding to that an increase in the amount that the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, can underwrite in initial mortgages. So equally targeted and equally good. Third thing that the federal government can do, to the extent there was fraud, and evidently there was, the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston has done a lot of work on this. People who could have qualified for ordinary mortgages shoved into subprime. Some characterization of racial discrimination in so doing. These are serious problems. They should be addressed, including prosecution, to the extent that laws were broken. The Boston Fed reported that 60% of those receiving subprime loans qualified for higher quality regular loans. So there is some very serious problem there, obviously. That needs to be enforced as well. What else can the federal government do? Federal monetary policy, I was going to suggest a half-point cut to the Federal Reserve Board in my remarks today, and I'm glad that they got the advance copy of my remarks and decided to do so. So federal funds rate down at 3%. How far down can we go? Well, remember, they went as low as 1% as recently as June of 2003. So we've got a lot of space still for monetary policy. Now, what will monetary policy do? To some extent, pushing on a string. Because the question is, who wants to lend money to buy a house? Much more targeted, much more sensible is the change in Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, FHA. That's more targeted to get people to underwrite the purchasing of the house, building up the wealth effect. Simply lowering the federal funds rate and the discount rate doesn't have that direct effect. Remember, those are short term. All the Fed can do is affect short term. It can pray that it affects long term rates, but all its policy instruments are directed to short term. Not zero in effect, however, because of the readjustment of credit card debt, right? So credit card debt is going to be affected by the lower federal funds and discount rate, and that's going to make it a little bit easier on consumers, so that's a beneficial thing. Debt service is now 14.5% of disposable income in our country, which is the highest it's been since 1980. What's the downside of the Fed continuing to drop interest rates, possibly rekindling inflation? However, the market in the inflation-protected bonds is showing no anticipation of inflation. To the extent we have inflation in sectors, it's due to the higher price of petroleum, natural gas, and that is a different kind of inflation in the sense that it is understood to be due to one commodity and not the basis for the wage push inflation that could be more of a permanent problem. So no real risk of the Fed lowering discount rates even further and much room to do so. Again, I'm trying to give you some positives in my analysis. On the fiscal side, $150 billion of fiscal stimulus in the House bill, and the Senate promises to add more. Here I'm going to be just a little bit, I was going to say cynical, but I'm never cynical. It's not a good thing to be. Experienced. It's an election year. My gosh, who's not in favor of stimulus? I'm in favor of the stimulus to the people of my district, particularly those in the demographics likely to vote for me. And what's not to be in favor? Well, so we get $600 for every individual, $1,200 for working couples, $300 for child, refundable even if you never paid any tax. You'll just get a check from the government. Phases out at $174,000, so if you're making more than $174,000, you'll have to do without the $600 check. So why am I giving a experienced tone to my characterization of this? Because I don't know an employer who's going to hire more people on the basis of the economic stimulus from folks spending a $600 one-time check. I don't know a company that's going to add capacity to manufacturing on that basis. And we can spend the money more wisely targeted to keeping people in their homes. So that would be my recommendation. The rebates are not going to affect permanent behavior and thus not economic growth. But the Fannie Mae, FHA, Freddie Mac will. And if you want to spend $150 billion, spend it directly in the segment of the market of people who, because of the adjustable rate mortgages or because of the value of their houses going down, are at risk of moving out. The people that Wall Street Journal op-ed writer wrote about. Get those people in their homes. If you have to spend $150 billion, spend it there. I want to end with just a quick comment and then go to your questions about the danger of $150 billion. I think I am the only one left in America, a bit of an exaggeration, who actually said, how much would $150 billion add to the deficit? I mean, have you heard any candidate for president ask how much it adds to the deficit? Maybe Ron Paul. I'm sorry, I'm not here promoting any one candidate, but if there were one, it probably was him. What I wanted you to have as a takeaway from today is a handout. So I hope this is available, made available to you. It's a list of the federal budget deficit, and I just want to put this in context. Where we are today, deficit 414, that's estimated by the Congressional Budget Office, and that was before they estimated probably another $30 billion not yet counted for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Add 150 to that, and that's 594. That brings the budget deficit as a percentage of GDP up from just under 3 to just over 4%. Total debt of the United States, $9.6 trillion. What is our total debt as a percentage of GDP? 67. And if you took this stimulus package, it would go up to just a shade under 69%. Look at the rate of growth over the decade from 2000 to 2008, the total debt as a percentage of GDP rising from 58 up to what would be 69%. What is the total debt of the United States? $9.195 trillion as of January 24th. The total debt number in 2008 is an estimate. So that's where those two numbers come from. If you sometimes hear people express this, politicians particularly, of which I am a recovering member, they'll say, but it's owed to ourselves, right? It's owed to ourselves. I never got that argument. Does that mean that the federal government is going to say, you know, senior citizens, that Social Security that we promised to pay you, we're not going to, because we owe it to ourselves. So, but that's how federal government accounting works, right? Federal government accounting works, treats the amount of money that we should have been putting aside for Social Security as available for immediate expenditure tomorrow. then there is no Social Security Trust Fund assets. There are no assets in the Social Security Trust Fund other than IOUs that some future Congress will at some point honor. So the business that we don't owe it to anybody but ourselves, therefore it's not important, is wrong. And the other aspect to bear in mind is the 50% mark was passed last year of the ownership of federal debt by other countries, citizens and national sovereigns of other countries. Putting a potential economic weapon in the hands of some of those holders, admittedly they would hurt themselves to exercise it, but it always worries me that you create an economic weapon in that it happens when you owe so much to other countries. The danger is this. It's disappointing to me that nobody even asked what is the effect of a new $150 billion on the deficit. If it's targeted to stimulus in precisely the area needed, homeowners who might otherwise leave their homes, I think it's the right thing. If not, I'm afraid that it's going to add to the conception around the world that the United States is fiscally irresponsible, and that if I'm OPEC or China, I'm going to put my money in euros rather than dollars. And we've seen that trend beginning. If that becomes permanent, you're going to see people in the United States paying higher and higher long-term interest, because in order to attract foreign money, we're going to have to pay the higher long-term interest. And that is very, very serious economically. The last thing I put on my handout is that if you take the rate of payback, this is a number that I'm trying to popularize. I've not seen it done otherwise, so let me ask you to be vanguard of the popularization of this concern. How many years would it take to pay back the debt if we really meant to pay back the debt? And the answer is 240 years. So that's on the page here, and I give you the websites that you can check my calculations. In conclusion, keep people in their homes should be the center of the focus in the current economic environment because of the wealth effect, not because of the cash out of equity, but because of the wealth effect. That is where the serious long-term effect is. Two, the present federal stimulus package is misdirected, but it could be redirected, and I hope that we see that. Certainly Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA is correct. And lastly, the possibility remains, although it hasn't been seriously developed yet, that the state or the federal government could help homeowners by being co-owners. And here's what I mean. It's a concept that has not yet been adopted, but ought to get serious consideration. You may not want to have 100% of the value of the equity in your home. That might not be a wise allocation of risk among your various assets. If, and I am among those, you believe the market is going to come back for housing, then rather than a gift of money, the federal government might be a co-investor with you in your home. And a long-term investor with a long-term view, thus lowering your debt service, thus making you more likely to stay in your home, and then we all gain when the housing market comes back. Thank you very much for your attention. I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thanks. Our thanks to Tom Campbell, the Bank of America Dean of the Haas School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley, for his comments today. I'm Mary Cranston, the chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and the firm's senior partner at the law firm of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, and I will be moderating the questions that we've received from the audience today. So we have a lot of questions, Dean Campbell, and let's begin. You mentioned that the most significant impact of the current housing issues were the value level of the housing and the impact that will have on people's feelings of wealth. But we did have a number of questions about the subprime situation itself and how we got into that. And could you give us your views on what was the source and cause of that and how we could avoid that in the future?
Sure. The subprime was overextended. There is clear evidence that people with financial difficult balance sheets, nevertheless, were encouraged to take out loans. There's a strong suggestion that assets were not checked. Indeed, maybe in a few instances, even complicity between the lender. And why was all of that possible? Because of a belief that housing prices could only go one direction. So if we're only going to go up, why not give you the loan? Don't worry. And before the ARM, the adjustable rate mortgage, kicks in, your house will have appreciated so much, you will cash that out and get into a fixed. That's why it was a belief in the non-ending growth of housing. There's a fairly loud chorus criticizing the Federal Reserve for easy credit under the Greenspan years. I don't blame them with the specificity that others have. I think what Greenspan was doing was trying to bet against a recession and made it actually less of a severe downturn at the start of his time. It was rather this belief that housing prices had only one way to go, which led to the crisis we now know as subprime.
One of our readers was wondering whether we learned some lessons from our last bubble, which was the technology bubble in the early part of this century, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts about lessons learned, things we could do this time around.
Only one, and that is that all bubbles are realized after they burst.
Profound and true, unfortunately.
Thank you. I try my best to deal in profundities. Here's the difference, right? The high-tech bubble, which hurt all of us here in greater Silicon Valley, did not have the wealth effect. So this is in many ways more serious because of that fact that overwhelmingly most Americans save and act as though they save in their house. So even though you want your stock portfolio to go up, when it goes down, your consumption pattern does not change as much, but your housing value has a much greater effect. So the only comparison that I would say is that all markets will eventually correct. If you see any asset rising at 7 times the rate of inflation, you should be prepared to use the B word, a bubble.
How long a time do you think it will take for the economy to turn back around?
Ken Rosen, who's my colleague on the faculty at Haas, predicts 1.5 years in the state of California. And I think that might be a little bit longer than the national average. So he's the expert. He runs the Fisher Center in real estate. And what does he base that on? Inventory, the number of available homes. I'd say that we can make that faster. We can make the recovery occur faster if we do get Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and FHA into the mortgage for the higher value properties that I described.
What's your forecast for the health of the financial services sector over the next couple of years, or as one of our more practical listeners said, should I sell my bank stocks?
You should have sold your bank stocks. Except the sponsor of this lunch. The write-downs have been large. I don't think anybody's holding back. I don't think the law would permit them to. The liability after Sarbanes-Oxley is so great that no financial institution, I believe, would be holding back. So I believe that we have seen the impact reflected in share values in investment banks and commercial banks. Further news, of course, might hit the papers tomorrow, this particularly French electronic geniuses and their ability to incur losses. But putting that odd phenomenon to one side, I am sanguine. I think that CEOs have lost their jobs. Footnote with golden parachutes I cannot believe or explain. Nevertheless, they've lost their jobs, and the market has written down the values of those banks. So it's a good investment going forward.
Thanks, Tom. Let me just say for our radio announcement that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our speaker today is Tom Campbell, Dean of the Haas School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley, who is discussing the national, regional, and global economic outlook for 2008. A number of questions, Tom, on bond insurer stability and what you see going forward, and looking particularly to your experience as the Chief Finance Officer of California, what do you think is going to happen?
I think we got a shock. I think we thought that bond insurers and the process of evaluating risk was much more sophisticated and were more reliable than they actually were. That, I think, is a tough conclusion, but it's inescapable. When I was finance director of California, it was my privilege to argue for a lower interest rate for California bonds related to a higher bond rating. And so I had the opportunity to argue on behalf of our state with Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch's. And it was an interesting exercise because I began to see what they were focusing on. The sovereign state of California, of course, cannot default. It's unconstitutional to default. Smaller units of government can. Federal government can inflate, but the state of California must actually sell assets of California before it defaults on a bond. It cannot default on a bond. It is unconstitutional. So the Constitution of the United States would fall before the state of California would default on a bond. Berkeley would have to sell the Wheeler Auditorium to whoever wants to buy the Wheeler Auditorium. No doubt the city of Berkeley would to further enhance its influence among the students on the campus. What I learned was that the bond rating agencies were largely looking at what's the prospect of a postponement in a payment, a workout, not a question of actual default. At that level, that's what I learned. What is clear in hindsight is that the degree of risk of adjustable rate mortgages and the securities that backed them, that they were used to back, was not priced accurately. So those that we relied on to make those estimates got it wrong. And we also understood the centrality of their function in the market. But the iBanks who made that mistake, relying on those insurers and those bond agency ratings, paid the price.
One last question in the real estate area. It's from a young person in the audience who's looking to buy a house. Should they wait until this real estate crisis is over to purchase?
If I were still finance director of California, I'd say no, go right out and buy and spend everything else you have buying California bonds. But I'm no longer finance director. You've got a declining market. My good colleague and expert friend Ken Rosen says it's a year and a half. I'm not going to advise somebody to buy into a falling market. Now, what would be right for America and right for our country is to get more people buying homes as quickly as possible. My main point today, because of the wealth effect, that people will then begin to consume more, the economy kickstarts. But no, I think we've got a period of correction. There's no way I can say to the contrary.
Tom, you mentioned a number of factors in our economy that are moving in a positive direction, and I have a number of questions on those areas. I'd like to turn to that now. One question was, as the dollar falls and the euro strengthens, what do you think will be the impact in the world money markets, and is the euro going to replace the dollar as the currency of choice?
The euro is already replacing the dollar as the currency of choice. OPEC and Japan and China are diversifying their sovereign holdings, and individual investors are diversifying their holdings into euro-denominated assets. That is wise. The equivalent of the Federal Reserve Board chair in China announced that policy for his government over a year ago. It's already happening. When President Reagan and Speaker Tip O'Neill were dealing with each other, and as a result, we increased spending faster than revenue, and the deficit grew. It was financed by OPEC and, in those days, Japan, who had no place else to put their money. The U.S. Treasury bond was the safest long-term investment for OPEC. Euro-denominated bonds now compete with the U.S. dollar-denominated sovereign debt. And so it's already happening. A basket, at the least, I think, is where OPEC will be going for their investments. Impact of that, interest rates will rise. Long-term interest rates will rise in the United States. It has to happen because the demand is increasing. How much is the demand increasing? The amount of the deficit every year. And it just got $150 billion bigger. So what is the deficit expected this year, including the stimulus package? $594 billion, half a trillion. That's increased demand. Half a trillion increased demand over and above what we're already borrowing. If Europe and OPEC does not continue to supply that demand, prices have to go up. That's what happens when demand for a good increases and the supply does not. The good in this question is money, and the price of the good is interest rates. So it's a pretty straightforward economic proposition that long-term interest rates going up is the inevitable consequence of the switch away from the dollar as the international store of value towards the euro.
As you look at the dollar and its implications on our trade positions, what do you see as the flow of goods and the changes in our economic markets that will be happening over the next couple of years?
First of all, the overwhelming effect is a good one. Whatever we make and pay our workers in dollars will fetch a higher rate of return in euros or pounds as the dollar continues to decline, or yen relative to those other currencies. So that means we increase our competitive posture. We become more competitive compared with other nations' production. And that's a good thing. And it's been a long time since trade has been a positive flow. But remember in the text of my remarks how much I showed the positive side of trade. Shifting, though, the law of comparative advantage has not been repealed. And that means that America will be increasing our sale of exports, but it will be those in which we have a comparative advantage, which is capital-intensive, not labor-intensive. Interestingly, American agriculture is capital-intensive. Some people think that it's labor-intensive because they have this notion of agriculture being the husbandman with a scythe. No, the output per worker in agriculture is substantially higher than any of our competitors in the world. It is a capital-intensive area. So exports will continue to be faster because of the declining dollar, but will continue to be capital-intensive.
You've touched on this a little bit already, but a number of our listeners were very interested on your views as to what's going to happen with our trade relationship with China over the next 5 years. And could you expand on that a little bit?
There's every reason to be optimistic. One tiny footnote about Taiwan, but let me be optimistic first. China's rate of growth is likely, I see no reason to be pessimistic, likely to continue at its recent pace, so 9-10% per year. That is going to call on a lot of input from the United States, again, of a high technology nature. It's going to help us in Silicon Valley, of a capital intensive nature. That's to the good. On the downside, it's going to demand raw materials that we might compete for, but we're not going to be building a whole lot of residences in the near future. So at least in that area, it won't have the negative impact that we might otherwise have had. I see continued positive growth and good trade relations with China. I see a pragmatism governing in the Chinese trade relations. Now the footnote, not every country behaves in its own economic best interest all the time. That goes with the profundity of the bubble is realized when it pops. But I think it's worth pausing just for a moment. If you make your estimate about China's behavior on saying, oh, China will always act in its own economic best interest, you'd be denying history, because there are exceptions in every country's history. And here the issue would be, would China ever make use of its huge accumulation of U.S. Treasury bonds to influence American policy? How could it? By selling those bonds all at once, dumping them on the market. Why is that not likely? Because it hurts China, right? They'd be devaluing their own asset by dumping it all on the market. But they sure as heck would cause a crisis in the U.S. And it would drive up interest rates overnight. And Taiwan, I think, is something that you might properly put under the heading of non-rational, non-economic, but real possibility. So watch the Taiwan elections, see where our government is in connection with any potential statement on sovereignty, and that is the one footnote I would make to my otherwise optimistic prediction that trade relations between us and China are going to continue to be positive.
Actually, that leads very nicely into another question that I got from several listeners, which is and you may have already answered it, but if you have any other thoughts, which are, what are the trade and security implications generally of sovereign wealth funds investing into the United States?
The sovereign wealth fund is fascinating, a relatively recent development, because it's not just buying debt. It's taking a bet on the United States economy. And I'm optimistic. I don't have a problem with the fact that foreign investors are, include countries who have now an economic interest in America doing well. That's the, you know, the 90% probability or the 99% probability of my description of the China situation. It's a good thing, not a bad thing, that our trade partners in the world have an interest and are doing well. So I see that as positive. The one risk that I described before is to the extent we have passed that 50% mark or any high mark. I've given this example once before, but not in this audience, so I'd like to take 30 seconds more to say an example, 1956. For those, some in the room who can remember it, I guess legally and technically could remember it. The United States exercised influence on Britain in order to get Britain to withdraw support for Israel in the Suez Crisis. Nasser had nationalized the Suez Canal. Israel, France, and England worked together to invade the Suez Canal, and President Eisenhower took the position in favor of Egypt and against France, England, and Israel. And the influence that he brought to bear, England had so much debt owed to, that they owed to the United States after World War II. Eisenhower called up Anthony Eden and said, I'm going to dump it on the market unless you withdraw your support and the Israeli troops pulled out of the Suez Canal. And England has never again been a force of diplomatic strength in the Middle East. So that is the real-life example, admittedly 52 years ago. But it can happen when you have so much that you as a country owe to another country, as England did to us at that time.
Thank you, Tom. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Tom Campbell, Dean of the Haas School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley, who is discussing the national, regional, and global economic outlook for 2008. Well, Tom, you're a brilliant and practical economist. You're also a very skilled politician, so I don't think it's going to surprise you that we got a lot of questions here about your views on the candidates and their economic policies. And so I'm just going to lob you a softball to answer whatever of that you want to.
Oh, okay. So I'd like to spend the rest of my remarks on John Edwards' economic package
I do
for
have
America.
A hook.
So the race comes down fairly clearly now to two Democratic senators and one former governor and one former senator, one present senator on the Republican side. The track record of each is worth discussing. And I've got to do this because I very much have succeeded, I think, I hope I've succeeded, in being nonpartisan as the dean of the world's greatest business school. So let me continue to try to be nonpartisan. There's no question that the two Democratic candidates are more willing to see the size of the federal government grow and to see the tax cuts that President Bush advocated rotate off in 2010. And the most important one there to me is the capital gains reduction. So even though you can talk about it's only reverting to where it was, both Democratic candidates appear to be committed to what is going to have the effect of an increase in capital gains tax rates in 2010. I hope I said that as nonpartisanly as possible. On the Republican side, you have a commitment to all of the President Bush tax cuts, whether they're economically productive of growth or not, almost a religious test. That wait, didn't you at one time not vote for the tax cuts of George Bush? Yes, says this individual candidate, but that's only because there weren't offsetting cuts. Oh, that makes you a Calvin Coolidge Republican, not a Ronald Reagan Republican, because you actually cared about balancing the budget. that is the level of debate at the moment. And now I'll conclude on that by saying I think all four of the likely final four, you might call them, candidates, are going to be pragmatic once they get into the White House and try to get a recovery going. And if I were advising them, that would be don't increase the capital gains tax cut. That's going to curb a recovery. And direct the help that you have to the kind of problem that you have, in this instance, the homeowners, rather than simply across the board to a rebate. And once the campaigns are behind us, I think all four candidates will are responsible enough individuals to take a fresh look at the economy and to approach it in that manner. Right now, we're a little bit in the are you loyal enough to be the nominee of this party? And some of those tests are silly.
Thank you. You're in a unique position, I think, to comment on what you see as the future of funding for education in this country. You're the dean of a public university business school, and we have a number of questions on what the impact of the housing downturn is going to do to educational funding and other maybe more progressive or long-term solutions that you might put forward.
The effect in the state of California is real and immediate. The governor's 10% across the board cut includes the University of California, the California State University System, and the K through 14, so community colleges and K through 12. Even though the K through 14 area has a constitutional protection under Prop 98, it has a provision for a year when revenue drops or fails to increase as quickly as had been expected, and this is such a year. So the governor's put forward a across-the-board cut, including closing state parks, and the education system is not going to be exempt from it. It's my prediction that there will be bargaining back and forth with the legislature, that there might, by the end of that bargaining, be some compromise that includes increase in taxes. If that's the case, then the cuts will be a little bit less. But no solution I've heard discussed excludes serious cuts in higher education in the present budget environment. That's damaging to our state long term, and it is unnecessary. What do I mean unnecessary? Not unnecessary in the immediate crisis, but unnecessary because we should not have ratcheted up state spending in the good years at the rate that we did. Do you realize there is absolutely no appetite in Sacramento to spend less than the complete increase in revenue in any given year? What that leads to then is when you have a downturn, which naturally you will, you then have to do the cuts rather than a slower ramping up. Much wiser to have a slower ramping up, but that's the effect. So the governor has put forward a proposal I think is sensible, but this will require a constitutional amendment, which means all of our voting for it, or a majority of us voting for it, that says you should not increase spending in any year more than the previous 10 years' average increase in revenue. I think that's wise. And then you'd have a reserve account which would cushion a year like this, so that the University of California, California State University, community colleges, and K through 12 could plan long term instead of bring on teachers, lay off teachers, bring on programs, lay off programs. So the smoothing out effect is right, and I believe the governor will have bipartisan support for that proposal.
Tom, you tried that proposal in Prop 76 in 2005, and it was rejected. Do you think there's a different political climate now that would maybe pass it?
I do. My assessment of the loss in Prop 76 was that it was related to another part of that proposal. The other part of that proposal said that when you had a drop in revenue or an increased expenditure more than 1% in a quarter, on an annualized basis, more than 1%, but in a quarter, the legislature had 45 days to fix the problem, and if they failed to, then the governor get to choose where to cut. That was not the way I drafted Prop 76, but that is the way it went to the people because of the difference as between the groups that put it on the ballot and what I drafted that I went on behalf of the governor to the legislature with. What I drafted and put to the legislature was, if you had that sort of a fiscal crisis, the legislature couldn't solve it, then everything gets on across-the-board cuts. I think that would have been more attractive because it would have shared the pain. But the opposition was able to say that the governor gets to choose the cuts. Oh, my gosh, he's going to choose whatever is the program you most like. And that was very hard to run against. So that part of Prop 76, which said, let's be careful about a long-term average spending, not cycle up and down, I think that was not the reason we lost. And so I'm optimistic that this can happen.
Okay. You know, the world is facing the global warming crisis, and that will obviously require a lot of investment, and there will be winners and losers in that in the international marketplaces. And I was wondering what you thought would be the net benefit or loss to the United States of dealing with that over the next 10 years?
It very much depends on whether we get a reliable buy-in from all the major economies who are our competitors. Again, I'm not saying anything strikingly insightful there, but it's worth noting. If we proceed with our competitors, our trading partners, put it that way, towards solutions towards global warming that are more or less comparable, we will do just fine. In fact, we'll do better because of our ability to adapt and because of our high technology, particularly in California, to provide solutions of manufacturing processes that produce less global greenhouse gases. The danger, of course, is if we don't. And if we go ahead with substantial rules applied only to us that don't apply to our trading partners, we will lose in individual competition with them. We will not be the lower cost provider, and we will have, in effect, imposed the cost of global warming upon all of those who create global warming. So it really turns on that. Will the Bali Accord, which seems to now to be likely to be the template for replacing the Kyoto Accord, will that get serious buy-in from China above all else or not? If it does, we have nothing to fear from these steps to reduce global warming. If it does not, we will have to balance out a competitive difference.
Thanks, Tom. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for only one last question. And in light of what's happened over the last couple of days with Governor Schwarzenegger's proposed reform on health care in the state of California, I thought I would pick that as the last question and get your views on what the governor proposed and what you think the prospects are of health care reform in this country in the next few years.
I have nothing but praise for the governor and for Speaker Fabian Nunez for trying. And it was remarkable how far they got, bringing in disparate points of view. I praise them for it. I do not criticize Senator Parada. I recognize his observations were directed to the fact that the proposal of the governor and the speaker would have a substantial cost, and that it was one thing to put that idea forward when the economy of California was better and when the budget was balanced. It is no longer balanced to the tune of $14.5 billion over a year and a half. But I want to start with a note of praise. Secondly, it is very, very difficult to solve the health care needs of our country on a state-by-state basis. The danger is that if we do a responsible job in California, we will probably add to the cost of doing business in California. And that drives businesses who can move to Nevada and Arizona. So, although I'm praised the governor and the speaker for what they've done, be willing to try to see if they can try again. Fundamentally, it focuses us back, and we'll see this, I think, a lot in the autumn campaign, on the necessity for a national approach so that you don't pay a penalty for having the farsightedness to address the needs of medical care in your own state.
Thanks, Tom. I'm going to just actually read one last question and pose it to you somewhat rhetorically. Tom, don't you think it's time to get you back in politics? The U.S. Senate needs you.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Tom Campbell.
Thank you, Mary. That was sweet.
We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.